Smith versus Medical Benefit Administration, Administrators Group.
May it please the court. My name is Doug Daler on behalf of the plaintiff appellant Jeffrey Smith. This appeal arises from a Rule 12b-6 dismissal of Mr. Smith's complaint alleging that a third-party administrator of an employee health benefit plan breached fiduciary duties under ERISA. The facts are relatively straightforward, so unless the court has questions about the particular facts, I've sort of delved into the legal issues here that are at stake. At bottom, this appeal involves the scope of the relief afforded by ERISA's civil remedial provisions, specifically those set forth in 29 U.S.C. 1132A2 and A3.
You know, I did have a question about that because the relevant provision of ERISA is Section 1132A3. Is it not?
I believe that 1132A2 is applicable as well.
Because the injury here was to Mr. Smith and to members of the proposed class as opposed to the plan. So in what sense is Section 1132A2 relevant? What is the plan's injury, if any?
Our position is that, number one, the Massachusetts versus Russell case that relies on this entire plan language has been substantially modified by the LaRue case, which asked the courts below to look at the purposes of ERISA rather than the specific entire plan language that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals relied on in that case. In this case, what we're asking for is equitable relief as well as remedial relief. Section A2, we're asking for a declaratory order concerning Auxient's fiduciary obligations with respect to pre-service claims. And below, Auxient will dispute and has disputed that it's a fiduciary and that it that it's obligated to comply with the claims handling regulations. What we're asking for is a declaratory order under A2 that will benefit not only Mr. Smith, but all members of the plan, and indeed, because this is a potential class action, other participants and beneficiaries of other plans that are administered by Auxient, to clarify what the obligations are with respect to third-party administrators and their duties to decide pre-service claims in a manner that's prudent and consistent with the claims handling regulations. So to that extent, we believe that declaratory relief as well as appropriate injunctive relief would benefit not only Mr. Smith, but the entire plan and potentially participants and beneficiaries in other plans. We are also alleging that under A3, that this, if A2 is not the appropriate section, that A3 is a catch-all provision under ERISA that also allows for equitable relief.
I guess that I just could not under any circumstances see where you, to the extent that Mr. Smith sought relief on behalf of the plan itself under 1132A2, that he could possibly state a viable claim for relief. In other words, it's he and the other class members who were injured by being denied coverage, not the insurance plan itself. This isn't a case in which plan assets were stolen or misused, for example. And because it's Smith and the putative class members who suffered injuries, it's A3, which can be the only relevant provision of ERISA. Both Kenseth and Mondry explain at quite some length that only traditional forms of equitable relief are available under this provision. And to the extent that the company would seek contemporaneous compensatory damages for the financial injuries that Smith and others suffered as a result of Auxient's erroneous or delayed pre-authorization decisions, the complaint seeks legal rather than equitable relief, and as such would be foreclosed by ERISA, and Knesset makes that clear. But declaratory and injunctive relief is available. And the complaints prayer for relief did seek both of these types of equitable relief. So,
yes, Your Honor, and I, if I'm not interrupting.
No,
I understand the point, and I think that the point is that perhaps ERISA's remedial provisions aren't as clear as, in my view, my humble view, as some might believe. The opinions are, especially in light of LaRue, a little bit difficult to parse out. Our view is that A2 is first and foremost applicable because we're seeking equitable relief that will benefit not only Mr. Smith, but the entire plan, meaning all the plan beneficiaries and participants, by clarifying Auxient's responsibilities to decide pre-service claims appropriately.
Okay, well, then let me get this clear in my own mind. To the extent that you're seeking compensatory damages, wouldn't our recent decision in Kenseth make clear that this sort of monetary relief for you is unavailable?
With respect to monetary relief, A2 provides for equitable and remedial relief, appropriate equitable and remedial relief. What we're saying is that equitable and remedial relief, the portion of that remedial relief has to mean something other than equitable relief. The Congress enacted that phrase, equitable and remedial relief, and included the phrase remedial in Section A2, not in A3. What does remedial relief mean? Remedial relief has to mean something other than equitable relief. And based on Justice Scalia's decisions, opinions in Mertens and in the Great West Life case, we know that you have to look carefully at the words of the statute, and every word matters. And with respect to what remedial relief means, there's somewhat of an absence in the case law as to what remedial relief means for purposes of A2. So getting back to your point about monetary relief, our position is that remedial relief is something other than equitable relief, and therefore it must be some sort of legal relief. There are two sort of worlds that Justice Scalia discussed. There's equitable relief on one hand, there's legal relief on the other. Under A2, it talks in terms of equitable relief and remedial relief. Well,
could
if remedial.
You pretend that you're dealing with a real fool?
I'm sorry.
Could you just tell me this?
Yes.
As you stand here today, do you really think that monetary relief is available to you no matter what we do in this case?
I believe restitution is appropriate, and restitution can constitute monetary relief. And my point was that restitution is something that Justice Scalia has discussed can be legal in nature and equitable in nature. For purposes of A3, Justice Scalia in the Great West Life case said that legal equitable relief with respect to restitution, that restitution could be either legal or equitable. With respect to equities, restitution is essentially the imposition of a constructive trust.
Remind me, is his the majority opinion?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yeah. So it is with the imposition of a constructive trust. With respect to legal relief, restitution can also be legal relief, but it's more along the lines of imposing a judgment or obtaining a judgment to impose liability on another party. We contend that under A2, if remedial relief means anything, that Justice Scalia's analysis from those Supreme Court decisions, including Great West Life, suggests that restitution under A2 means something more, or is available not only from an equitable standpoint, but from a legal standpoint. It's I think, a logical jump to say that if A3 only allows equitable restitution because the language is equitable relief, that A2, when it talks in terms of equitable and remedial relief, authorizes something other than just equitable restitution, includes restitution at law. And under Justice Scalia's decision, he talks about the history of restitution and the nature of equitable versus legal. Legal restitution is in its nature akin to unjust enrichment or has its origins in breach of contract. So what I'm suggesting is that the restitution at law that would be available under A2 would be of the nature of unjust enrichment or breach of contract damages. Breach of contract damages don't extend to punitive damages. Breach of contract damages don't ordinarily extend to emotional distress damages. So in this case, I believe that there is monetary relief available in the form of legal restitution that consists either of something akin to breach of contract damages or something akin to unjust enrichment. So how was Auxient unjustly enriched? By not following the pre-service guidelines. Well, as I explained in my brief, pre-claim service guidelines, they have to, Auxient has an obligation to respond within 15 days. Obviously, it doesn't have the staff to do that and is not therefore complying with that and has been unjustly enriched. I notice that my time is complete. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. David. Mr. Smith.
It is still morning, barely, so good morning. I'm Todd Smith. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Todd Smith of the law firm Godfrey & Kahn. With me at the counsel table is my co-counsel, Patricia Wheeler, and we represent the defendant appellee in this case, Medical Benefit Administrators, which I think the court understands is more commonly known as Auxient. The appellant in this case seeks an end run around ERISA's carefully defined remedial scheme. It has been the law of the land for over 25 years that a participant may not sue for extra contractual benefits, that is, amounts or damages representing benefits that are not due under the terms of his or her welfare benefit plan. That rule was established in the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Russell, and none of the cases discussed earlier today or subsequently even purport to overrule that aspect of the Russell decision. Indeed, Russell and the cases that followed hold that a claimant cannot sue under either 502 A2 or A3 to recover damages representing benefits that he or she is not entitled to.
Now, Mr. Smith's prayer for relief did include requests for both a declaratory and injunctive relief, and he made that point in opposing Auxient's motion to dismiss below. So doesn't he have a viable claim for relief, at least as to those forms of equitable relief?
I don't believe he does, Your Honor, and I would agree with you that his complaint in the wherefore clause does parrot some of the language of ERISA's remedial scheme. But if you look at the facts alleged, what he's really seeking, what he really wants is for Auxient to be liable to him for his out-of-pocket damages that he alleges he incurred as a result of the denial of his claims, the realization that the claims weren't covered. So I think what he is seeking, if you look at the facts, is for Auxient to be liable to him for those money damages. That's damages. It's extra contractual damages, and it's not permissible. I'd go on to say, in addition, though, if we want to credit that language in the complaint, that it is also not enough to get him out of the starting gates here. I mean, as I mentioned, his wherefore clause does parrot the language of the statute, but to the extent of what type of injunction, what type of order would he be seeking? All that's come up in the briefing so far is an order that Auxient follow the law, follow these claim regulations. And I'd suggest that first of all, that type of relief has long been disfavored by this court and other courts. But also, if what he is seeking is an order regarding following the regulations, the regulations themselves have a provision that gives a remedy for failure to follow them. That remedy is you can proceed directly to court. You don't have to exhaust. You're excused of ERISA's exhaustion requirement. And you can sue for the remedies in ERISA. So I would suggest that type of injunction or declaration wouldn't be appropriate here. There's also been no allegation, I'd point out further in his complaint, that these regulations are somehow unclear or require this court's attention to interpret them.
Well, you know, this point is not addressed in the briefs, but I'm curious about it. What is the nature of a pre-authorization that we're talking about in this case? Does OPSI preauthorize medical services in the sense that it says these services are within the scope of coverage and will be reimbursed, or is it instead saying that it agrees these services are medically necessary? Does OPSI issue any type of, any type of disclaimer when it preauthorizes medical services?
It does, and obviously we don't have the factual record that's been developed because this case is postured on a Rule 12 motion.
Right.
But it does provide a review or an authorization for the services and state that you and that authorization does state you have to check the terms of your plan for actual coverage. What happened in this case, if we were to get into it, is what Mr. Smith received was an order of the type that said, these medical services are consistent with the diagnosis. They are appropriate. It says, review your plan for coverage. That's what happened here.
It's not a coverage decision.
It's not a coverage decision, Your Honor. You're right. And that's what we're left with if the facts were going to be developed. But as we've pointed out in our brief and as the district court recognized, The remedies that are being sought here are not ones that are recognized by ERISA. There's a couple.
That's not quite right. His complaint sought declaratory and injunctive relief.
Well, it did purport that to seek that relief in the wherefore clause. But as I've tried to argue, if you look at the facts that are alleged, he's really seeking damages. And to what end of the declaratory relief would this court be? What would be proper to declare or to interpret here? The claims regulations are not being deemed to be in need of interpretation or unclear. There's no allegation that the participant wasn't able to find the relevant terms of the plan. The type of relief he's seeking that has at least been identified in his complaint or more appropriately in the brief are not the kind of declaratory or equitable relief that the courts have recognized in the past.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, we're talking about a 12B6 here.
We are talking about a 12B6.
So we don't know. I mean, we do know that it seems to me that although ERISA authorizes equitable relief alone so that any form of monetary relief let's put it this way, is most likely unavailable to him and to his proposed class, we do have a complaint that seeks declaratory and injunctive relief. And why wouldn't, to that extent, the complaint be viable?
Well, I'd respond by saying, again, I don't believe there are facts to support that, and I believe it would fail even the Rule 8 notice pleading standard for what type of injunction or declaratory relief it's seeking, particularly if we then were to turn our attention to the Iqbal and Twombly pleading standards that are applied to this.
Well, the premise of his complaint seems to be, and I could be, flying off to Rio, but the premise of his complaint seems to be, is not that Auxient wouldn't pre-authorize services, but that it both dragged its feet in doing so and pre-authorized services only to turn around later and deny claims for reimbursement. So I guess, at this juncture, we can assume that pre-authorization was available and you admitted that it was. Didn't you?
Well, I don't believe we did on a Rule 12B motion.
No, but here in the courtroom.
Well, we talked about what facts might be developed. Yes, there was a notice given to him about the appropriateness of medical treatment, the proposed medical treatment for his diagnosis, with a disclaimer about you still need to check your plan for coverage. Auxient, as you know, Your Honor, administers claims for many different plans, the plaintiff's claim arose under his employer's plan, of course, and that's something that he would need to check with his HR person or something like that. Presumably he has a plan language or an SPD that he could consult. Those things aren't in the pleading, so we don't know. I will note also, if I may, there was some talk of the equitable remedy of restitution and even constructive trust. Mr. Daler made mention of those. Those cases and all the cases where those remedies have been afforded have been cases involving improperly denied benefits where the plan either and wrongfully denied benefits that should have been paid. And in that situation, we can all see why, for example, in Mondry, ordering the plan to pay interest for the wrongful denial of benefits made sense, because in that situation the plan may have benefited or would have benefited from the time value of money dragging its feet in the process. We don't have that situation here. There were no benefits that were wrongfully denied in this case, and it's not been mentioned yet, but it's important to note that the appellant concedes that the benefits ultimately weren't due, and I think that's one of the things that
that
the benefits ultimately weren't due.
Were
not due. If he had sought, if he believed that benefits were due under the terms of his plan, he would have sued the plan under ERISA 502A1B, which allows a participant to recover benefits due under the plan. And I submit he could have done that. He could have alleged that the conduct of the plan or something like that entitled him to the benefits he seeks despite the plan language. He didn't bring that lawsuit, though. He's trying to get those benefits, but he's trying to get them under the guise of a breach of fiduciary duty lawsuit, which I submit is improper.
But since declaratory and injunctive relief is available, and the complainant's prayer for relief did seek both of these types of equitable relief, and he also confirmed that he was seeking such relief in his memorandum opposing the motion to dismiss, surely it was error to dismiss this complaint.
My time is up, but I disagree, Your Honor. I don't believe you can satisfy the pleading standards simply by parroting the language in your wherefore clause in the complaint, nor do I believe the facts allege, or have we even discussed today, any type of remedial order or declaration of rights or order interpreting ERISA and their regs that really spell out a claim for relief in this case.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Smith.
Thank you.
Mr. Daler, you had no time, but you may have a minute to respond.
Briefly, on the issue of injunctive and declaratory relief, the complaint does allege that this is a pattern and practice that's engaged in by Auxient. That's an ongoing pattern and practice. It's something that's appropriate for declaratory and injunctive relief. We also believe that restitution is something that should be available. In the Harzewski case, we didn't have a chance to discuss it much, but in that case, Judge Posner found that the relief under A2 included an entitlement to prudent management was one of the, quote, benefits that was available to the participant. And that significant language there, because I don't believe it came from the plan document itself. So A2, according to Judge Posner, the benefits of the plan include an entitlement to prudent management of the plan.
Let me just ask one final question.
Sure.
Maybe it's the final question. The court were of the view that there was no specific financial gain for Mr. Smith, is it your position that Mr. Smith would be interested in correcting some perceived abuse on behalf of all plan members?
Absolutely. I mean, we brought this as a class action because of what we perceive to be a problem with the way this is handled within the industry. And he has brought suit alleging a pattern in practice and intends to pursue injunctive and declaratory relief.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.